Scala, the journalist who had started it all. She also resolved one day to confront a nasty columnist pictured in a checked jacket whose article had made repeated jocular references to Mimi as an S&M dyke. The number of people Salander was going to have to deal with was growing. But first, she had to find Zala. What would happen when she found him, she didn't know. Blomqvist was woken by the telephone at 7:30 on Sunday morning. He stretched out his hand and answered it sleepily.
"Good morning," Berger said.
"'M-m-m," said Mikhail.
"Are you alone?"
"Unfortunately."
"Then I suggest you take a shower and put on some coffee. You'll have a visitor in 15 minutes."
"I will."
"Paolo Roberto."
"The boxer? The King of Kings?"
"He called me, and we talked for half an hour."
"How come?"
"How come he called me? Well, we know each other well enough to say hello. I did an interview with him when he was in Hildebrand's film, and we've run into each other a few times over the years."
"I didn't know that. But my question was, why is he visiting me?"
"Because, well, I think it's better if he explains that himself."
Blomqvist had only just showered and put on his pants when a doorbell rang. He opened the door and asked the boxer to take a seat at the table while he found a clean shirt and made 2 double espressos, which he served with a teaspoon of milk. Paolo Roberto inspected the coffee, impressed. "You wanted to talk to me," Blomqvist said.
"It was Erika Berger's suggestion."
"I see. Talk away."
"I know Lisbeth Salander."
Blomqvist raised his eyebrows. "You do?"
"I was a little surprised when Erika told me that you knew her too."
"I think perhaps it would be better if you started at the beginning."
"Okay. Here's the deal. I came home the day before yesterday, after a month in New York, and found Lisbeth's face on every fucking newspaper in town. The papers are writing a load of fucking crap about her, and not one of those fuckers seems to have a good word to say."
"You got 3 fucks into that outburst." Paolo Roberto laughed.
"Sorry, but I'm really pissed off. In fact, I called Erika because I needed to talk and didn't really know who else to call. Since that journalist in Enschede worked for Millennium, and since I happen to know Erika, I called her."
"So?"
"Even if Salander went completely off her rocker and did everything the police are claiming she did, she has to be given a sporting chance. We do happen to have the rule of law in this country, and nobody should be condemned without their day in court."
"I believe that too."
"That's what I understood from Erika. When I called her, I thought that you guys at Millennium were after her scalp too, considering that the Svensson guy was writing for you. But Erika said you thought she was innocent."
"I know Lisbeth. I can't see her as a deranged killer." Paolo Roberto laughed out loud.
"She's one fucking freaky chick. But she's one of the good ones. I like her."
"How do you know her?"
"I've boxed with Salander since she was 17.
Blomqvist closed his eyes for 10 seconds before he opened them and looked at the boxing champ. Salander was, as always, full of surprises. "Of course. Lisbeth Salander boxes with Paolo Roberto. You're in the same division."
"I'm not joking."
"I believe you. She told me once that she used to spar with the boys at some boxing club."
"Let me tell you how it happened. 10 years ago I took a job as a trainer for juniors who wanted to start boxing down at the Zinken Club. I was already established, and the club's junior leader thought I'd be a big draw, so I come in afternoons and spar with the guys. As it turned out, I stayed the whole summer, and part of the autumn too. They ran a campaign and put up posters and all that, trying to lure the local kids. And it did attract a lot of 15- and 16-year-olds, and some a few years older too. Quite a few immigrant kids. Boxing is a great alternative to running around town and raising hell. Ask me, I know."
"I believe you."
"Then one day, in the middle of summer, this skinny girl turns up out of nowhere. You know how she looks, right? She came into the club and said she wanted to learn to box."
"I can picture the scene."
"There was a roar of laughter from 6 guys who weighed about twice as much as she did and were obviously a whole lot bigger. I laughed too. It was nothing serious, but we teased her a little. We have a girls' section, too, and I said something stupid about the fact that little chicks were only allowed to box on Thursdays, or something like that.
She didn't laugh, I bet.
No, she didn't laugh. She looked at me with those black eyes of hers. Then she reached for a pair of boxing gloves that somebody had left lying around. They weren't tied up or anything, and they were way too big for her. But we weren't laughing any more. You know what I mean?
This doesn't sound good. Paolo Roberto laughed again.
Since I was the instructor, I went up and pretended to jab at her, you know, for make-believe.
Uh-oh.
Right. All of a sudden, she whipped out a punch that caught me smack above my mouth. I was just clowning with her and was totally unprepared. She got in two or three punches before I even began to block them. Anyway, she had no muscle strength and it was like being walloped by a feather. But when I started blocking, she changed tactics. She boxed instinctively and landed a few more smacks. Then I started blocking seriously and found out that she was quicker than a fucking lizard. If she had been bigger and stronger, I would have had a match on my hands.
I am not surprised.
And then she switches tactics again, and whacked me a good one right in the balls. I felt that one.
Blomqvist winced.
Then I jabbed back and got her in the face. I mean, it wasn't a hard punch or anything, just a pop. Then she kicked me in the shin. Anyway, it was totally freaky. I was three times bigger and heavier, and she didn't have a chance, but she bashed at me as if her life was at stake.
You made her angry.
I realized that later. And I was ashamed. I mean, we had put up posters and tried to draw in young people, and here she came and asked quite seriously to learn to box, and ran up against a gang of guys who just stood there and made fun of her. I would have lost it too if anyone had treated me that way.
But you might have thought twice about having a crack at Paolo Roberto.
Well, Salander's problem was that her punches were worthless, so I started training with her. We had her in the girls' section for a couple of weeks, and she lost several matches because sooner or later somebody would always get a punch in, and then we had to sort of stop and carry her into the locker room because she was so mad and started kicking and biting and slugging us.
That sounds like Lisbeth.
She never gave up. But finally, she had pissed off so many girls that their trainer kicked her out.
And then?
It was completely impossible to box with her. She only had one style, which we called Terminator mode. She would try to nail her opponent, and it didn't matter if it was just a warm-up or friendly sparring. And girls kept going home, all scraped up because she had kicked them. That was when I had an idea. I had problems with a guy called Samir. He was 17 and from Syria. He was a good boxer, powerfully built and with a good jab, but he couldn't move. He stood still the whole time. So I asked Salander to come to the club one afternoon when I was going to train him. She changed and I put her in the ring with him, headgear and mouthpiece and everything. At first, Samir refused to spar with her because she was just a fucking chick, all the usual macho crap. So I told him, loud, so everyone could hear, that this was no sparring match, and I put up 500 kroner that said she would nail him. To Salander I said that this was no training session, and that Samir would pound her in bloody earnest. She looked at me with mistrust. Samir was still standing there babbling when the bell went off. Lisbeth went at him for king and country and thumped him one in the face so he went down on his ass. By then I'd been training her for a whole summer, and she was starting to get some muscles and a little power in her punch.
I'll bet your Syrian boy was happy.
Well, they talked about that match for months afterwards. Samir took a licking. She won on points. If she'd had more body strength, she really could have hurt him. After a while, Samir was so frustrated that he started slugging away full force. I was dead afraid he might actually land a punch and we'd have to call an ambulance. She took some bruises when she blocked with her shoulders a few times, and he managed to get her on the ropes because she couldn't stand up to the force of his blows, but he was nowhere near hitting her for real.
I wish I'd seen that.
That day the guys in the club began to respect Salander, especially Samir. So I started putting her in the ring to spar with considerably bigger and heavier guys. She was my secret weapon, and it was great training. We arranged sessions so that Lisbeth's goal was to land 5 punches on various parts of the body, jaw, forehead, stomach, and so on. And the guys she boxed with had to defend themselves and protect those areas. It turned into sort of a prestige thing to have boxed with Salander. It was like scrapping with a hornet. We actually called her the Wasp, and she became like the mascot of the club. I think she even liked it, because one day she came to the club with a wasp tattooed on her neck.
Blomqvist smiled. He remembered the Wasp well. And it was part of the police description of her. How long did all this go on?
One evening a week, for about 3 years. I was there full-time during that summer, and then sporadically after that. The guy who kept up the training with Salander was our junior trainer, Putney Carlson. Then Salander started working and didn't have time to come as often, but until last year she'd be there at least once a month. I saw her a few times a year and did sparring sessions with her. It was good training, and we were sweaty afterwards. She hardly ever talked to anyone. When there was no sparring, she would work the heavy bag intensely for 2 hours, as if it were her mortal enemy.
Chapter 23. Sunday, April 3rd, to Monday, April 4th. Blomqvist made 2 more espressos. He apologized when he lit a cigarette. Paolo Roberto shrugged. He had the public reputation of being a cocky type who would say exactly what he thought. Blomqvist quickly saw that he was just as cocky in private, but that he was an intelligent and modest human being. He reminded himself that Paolo Roberto had also made a bid for a political career as a Social Democrat candidate for Parliament. He definitely had something between his ears. Blomqvist found he was beginning to like him. "Why are you coming to me with this story?"
"That girl's really in the soup, right? I don't know what to do, but she probably could use a friend in her corner."
"I agree."
"Why do you think she's innocent?"
"It's hard to explain. Elizabeth is an uncompromising person, but I just don't believe the story that she could have shot Doug and Mia. Especially not Mia. For one thing, she had no motive."
"At least none that we know of."
"Fair enough. Elizabeth would have no problem using violence against somebody who deserved it. But I don't know. I've decided to challenge Bublansky, the detective in charge of the investigation. I think there's a reason why Doug and Mia were murdered. And I think the reason is somewhere in the story Doug was working on."
"If you're right, Salander will need more than a hand to hold when she's arrested. She'll need a whole other kind of support."
"I know." Paolo Roberto had a dangerous glint in his eye.
"If she's innocent, she's been subjected to one of the worst fucking legal scandals in history. She's been painted as a murderer by the media and the police. And after all the shit that's been written..."
"I know."
"What can we do? Can I help out somehow?"
"The best help we could offer would be to find an alternative suspect. That's what I'm working on. The next best thing would be to get to her before some police thug shoots her dead. Elizabeth isn't the type of person who would give herself up voluntarily."
"So, how do we find her?"
"I don't know. But there is one thing you could do. Something practical, if you have the time and energy."
"My girlfriend is away all week, so I do have the time and the energy."
"Well, I was thinking that since you're a boxer..."
"Yes?"
"Elizabeth has a girlfriend, Miriam Wu. You've probably read about her."
"Better known as the S&M Dyke. Yeah, I've read about her."
"I have her mobile number, and I've been trying to get hold of her. She hangs up as soon as she hears it's a reporter."
"I don't blame her."
"I don't really have time to chase after Froken Wu, but I read somewhere that she trains in kickboxing. I was thinking that if a famous boxer wanted to get in touch with her..."
"I'm with you. And you're hoping that she might provide a lead to Salander?"
"When the police interviewed her, she said she had no idea where Lisbeth was staying. But it's worth a try."
"Give me her number. I'll talk to her."
Blomqvist gave him the number and the address on Lundegarten. Björk had spent the weekend analysing his situation. His prospects, he decided, were hanging by a fraying thread, and he would have to make the most of the hand he'd been dealt. Blomqvist was a fucking swine. The only question was whether he could be persuaded to keep his mouth shut about the fact that Björk had hired the services of those bitches. It was a chargeable offence, and he would be fired if it were made public. the press would rip him to shreds. A member of the security police who exploited teenage prostitutes. If only those fucking cunts hadn't been so young. Sitting here doing nothing would certainly seal his fate. Bjork was smart enough not to have said anything to Blomqvist. He had read his expression. The man was in agony. He wanted information, but he was going to be forced to pay for it, and the price was his silence. Zala brought a whole new dimension to the murder investigation. Svensson had been hunting Zala. Bjurman had been hunting Zala. And Superintendent Bjork was the only one who knew that there was a link between Zala and Bjurman, which meant that Zala was a clue to the murders of Enschede and Odenplan. This created another serious problem for Bjork's future well-being. He was the one who had given Bjurman the information about Zalachenko, as a friendly gesture and in spite of the fact that the file was still top secret. That was a detail, but it meant that he had committed another chargeable offence. Furthermore, since Blomqvist's visit on Friday, he had involved himself in yet one more crime. As a police officer, if he had information in a murder investigation, it was his duty to inform his colleagues immediately. But if he gave the information to Bublansky or Ekström, he would implicate himself. It would all eventually come out. Not just the whores, but the whole Zalachenko affair. On Saturday he had gone to his office at the security police on Kungsholmen. He had picked out all the old documents about Zalachenko and read through them. He was the one who had written the reports, but it was many years ago. The oldest of the documents were almost 30 years old. The most recent was 10 years old. Zalachenko. A slippery fucker. Zala. Bjork himself had called him that in his report, although he could not remember ever having used the name. But the connection was crystal clear. To Enschede, to Bjurman, and to Salander. Bjork still did not understand how all the pieces of the puzzle fit together, but he thought he knew why Salander had been in Enschede. He could also easily imagine her flying into a rage and killing Svensson and Johansson, either because they had refused to cooperate or because they had provoked her. She had a motive, known only to Bjork and perhaps two or three other people in the whole country. "She is completely insane. I hope to God that some officer shoots her dead when she's apprehended. She knows. She could break the whole story wide open if she talked." No matter how Bjork looked at his situation, Blomqvist was his only possible way out, and that was the one thing that mattered to him. He felt a growing desperation. Blomqvist had to be persuaded to treat him as a confidential source and to keep quiet about his foolish escapades with those fucking whores. "Damn, if only Salander will blow Blomqvist's head off too." He looked at Zalachenko's phone number and weighed the pros and cons of contacting him. He was incapable of making up his mind. Blomqvist had made a point at every stage of summing up his thinking on the investigation. When Paolo Roberto left, he spent an hour on the task. It had turned into a journal in which he let his thoughts run free, while at the same time he meticulously wrote up every conversation and every meeting, as well as all the research he was doing. He encrypted the document using PGP and emailed copies to Berger and Eriksson so that his colleagues were kept up to date. Svensson had concentrated on Zala in the last weeks of his life. The name had cropped up in his final telephone conversation with Blomqvist 3 hours before he was killed. Bjork claimed to know something about Zala. Blomqvist ran through everything he had unearthed about Bjork, which was not very much. Gunnar Bjork was 62 years old, unmarried, born in Falun. Had been in the police force since he was 21. Began as a patrol officer, but studied law and ended up in SEPO, the security police, when he was 26 or 27. That was in 1969 or 1970, just at the end of Per Gunnar Winger's time as chief there. Winger was dismissed after making the claim in a conversation with Ragnar Lassinanti, the governor of Norrbotten County, that Olof Palme was spying for the Russians. Then came the internal bureau affair, and Holmer, and the letter carrier, and the Palme assassination, and one scandal after another. Bjork's career between 1970 and 1985 was largely undocumented, which was not so odd, since anything that had to do with SEPO activities was confidential. He could have been sharpening pencils in the stationery department, or he could have been a secret agent in China. In October 1985, Björk moved to the Swedish embassy in Washington for 2 years. In 1988, back with Seppo in Stockholm. In 1996, he became a public figure, appointed deputy bureau chief of the Immigration Division. Whatever that entailed. After 1996, he made various statements to the media in connection with the deportation of suspect Arabs, and drew particular attention in 1998 when several Iraqi diplomats were expelled. What does any of this have to do with Salander and the murders of Svensson and Johansson? Maybe nothing. But Björk knows about Salah. There has to be a connection. Berger told no one, not even her husband, from whom she rarely kept secrets, that she was going to Svenska Morgenposten. She had about a month left at Millennium. The anxiety was getting to her. The days would rush by, and suddenly she would be facing her last day there. She was also growing uneasy about Blomqvist. She had read his latest email with a sinking feeling. She recognized the signs. It was the same stubbornness that made him stick it out in Hedestad 2 years ago, the same obsessive determination with which he had gone after Wennerström. Since Maundy Thursday, nothing had existed for him but to find out who had murdered his friends and somehow to establish Salander's innocence. She fully sympathized with his objectives. Dag and Mia had been her friends too, but there was a side to Blomqvist that made her uncomfortable. He could become ruthless when he smelled blood. From the moment he had called her the day before and told her how he had challenged Bublansky and begun sizing him up like some fucking macho cowboy, she knew that the hunt for Salander would keep Blomqvist busy for the foreseeable future. She knew from experience that he would be impossible to deal with until he solved the problem. He would vacillate between self-absorption and depression. And somewhere in the equation he would also take risks that were probably utterly unnecessary. And Salander. Berger had met her only once, and she didn't know enough about that strange girl to share Blomqvist's certainty that she was innocent. What if Bublansky was right? What if she was guilty? What if Blomqvist did manage to track her down and she turned out to be a lunatic armed with a gun? Nor had Paolo Roberto's astonishing conversation earlier that morning been reassuring. It was good, of course, that Blomqvist was not the only one on Salander's side, but Paolo was a cowboy too. And where was she going to find someone to replace her? At Millennium? It was now becoming urgent. She thought of discussing the matter with Malm, but she couldn't tell him and still keep the news from Blomqvist. Blomqvist was a brilliant reporter, but he would be a disaster as editor-in-chief. She and Malm were much more alike, but she was not at all sure that he would accept the offer. Eriksson was too young, not confident enough yet. Nielsen was too self-absorbed. Cortez was a good reporter, but he was way too inexperienced. Lotta Karim was too flaky. And Berger could not be sure that Malm or Blomqvist would be happy with someone recruited from the outside. It was a hell of a mess. Not at all the way she wanted to end her tenure at Millennium. On Sunday evening, Salander opened Asphyxia 1.3 and went into the mirrored hard drive of Mick Bloom/laptop. He was not online, and she read through the material that had been added in the past 2 days. She read Blomqvist's research journal and wondered whether he might be writing it in such detail for her sake, and if so, what that could mean. He knew that she was accessing his computer, so it was natural to conclude that he wanted her to read what he wrote. The real question, however, was what he was not writing. Since he knew she was accessing his machine, he could manipulate the flow of information. She noted in passing that he apparently hadn't got much further with Bublansky than challenging him to some sort of a duel over her innocence. This annoyed her. Blomqvist was basing his conclusions on emotion rather than on facts. What a naive idiot. But he had also zeroed in on Zala. Good thinking, Caleb Blomqvist. Then she noticed with mild surprise that Paolo Roberto had popped up on the scene. That was good news. She smiled. She liked that cocky fucker. He was macho to his fingertips. He used to give her a pretty good drubbing when they met in the ring, the few times he managed to connect, that is. Then she sat up in her chair when she decrypted and read Blomqvist's most recent email to Berger.
Gunnar Bjork, Seppo, knows about Zala. Björk knows Björman.
Sallander's eyes went blurry as she sketched a triangle in her mind.
Zala, Björman, Björk. Yes, that makes sense.
She had never looked at the problem from that perspective before. Maybe Blomqvist wasn't so dumb after all. But of course he had not worked out the connection. She had not even done that herself, even though she had a lot more insight into what had happened. She thought for a while about Björman, and realized that the fact he knew Björk turned him into a bigger roadblock than she had previously imagined. She also realized that she would probably have to pay a visit to Smådalarö. Then she went into Blomqvist's hard drive and created a new document in the folder Lisbeth Sallander, which she called Ring Corner. He would see it the next time he switched on his iBook.
1. Keep away from Teleborian. He's evil.
2.
Miriam Wu has absolutely nothing to do with this.
3.
You're right to focus on Zala. He's the key. But you're not going to find him in any public records.
4.
There's a connection between Björman and Zala. I don't know what it is, but I'm working on it.
Björk?
5. Important. There's a damaging police report on me from March 1991. I don't know the file number and can't find it. Why hasn't Ekström given it to the media? Answer, it's not on his computer. Conclusion, he doesn't know about it. How can that be possible?
She thought for a moment and then added a P.S.
P.S. Mikael, I'm not innocent. But I didn't kill Dag and Mia. I have nothing to do with their murders. I saw them that evening, before the murders occurred, but I left them before it happened. Thanks for believing in me. Say hello to Paolo Roberto and tell him he has a wimpy left hook.
P.P.S.
How did you know about the Wennerström thing?
Blomqvist found Sallander's document some 3 hours later. He read the message line by line at least 5 times. For the first time she had clearly stated that she did not murder Svensson and Johansson. He believed her and felt enormous relief. And finally she was talking to him, although as cryptically as ever. He also noted that she denied murdering Dag and Mia, but she said nothing about Björman, which Blomqvist assumed was because he had mentioned only the two of them in his message. He thought for a while and then created Ring Corner 2.
Hi, Sally.
Thanks for finally telling me you're innocent.
I believed in you, but even I have been affected by the media noise and felt some doubt. Forgive me.
It feels good to hear it straight from your keyboard. All that's left is to uncover the real killer. You and I have done that before. It would help if you weren't so cagey. I assume you're reading my research journal. Then you know about as much as I do and how I'm thinking. I think Björk knows something, and I'll have another talk with him in the next few days. Am I on the wrong track, checking off the girl's clients? This thing with the police report surprises me. I'll get my colleague Malin Eriksson to dig into it. You were how old then? 12 or 13? What was the report about? Your attitude towards Teleborian is duly noted. M.
P.S.
You made a mistake in the Wennerström coup. I knew what you'd done, in Sandhamn, over Christmas, but didn't ask since you didn't mention it. And I have no intention of telling you what the mistake was, unless you meet me for a coffee.
The reply, when it came, said, You can forget about the Johns. Zala's the one who's of interest.
And a blonde giant.
But the police report is interesting since somebody seems to want to hide it. That can't be an accident.
Prosecutor Ekström was in a foul mood when Bublanski's team gathered for the morning meeting on Monday. More than a week's searching for a named suspect with a distinctive appearance had produced no result. Ekström's mood did not improve when Anderson, who had been on duty over the weekend, told him of the latest development.
A break-in?
Ekström said with undisguised amazement.
The neighbour called on Sunday evening to say that the police tape on Bjurman's door had been cut. I checked on it.
And?
The tape was cut in 3 places.
Probably a razor blade or a Stanley knife.
A slick job, it was hard to see. A burglary? There are hooligans who specialize in dead people's apartments.
Not a burglary. I went through the apartment. All the valuables, DVD player and such, were still there, but Bjurman's car key was lying on the kitchen table.
Car key?
Yerko was in the apartment on Wednesday to check if we'd missed something. He also checked the car. He swears there wasn't a car key on the kitchen table when he left the apartment and put the tape back up.
Could he have forgotten and left it out? Nobody's perfect.
Yerko never used that key. He used the one on Bjurman's key ring, which we had already confiscated.
Oblansky stroked his chin. So, not a normal break-in, then?
Someone got into Bjurman's apartment and sniffed around. It must have happened between Wednesday and Sunday evening when the neighbour telephoned.
Somebody was looking for something. What? Yerko?
There's nothing of any interest left in there. Nothing that we didn't already confiscate.
Nothing that we know of, at least. The motive for the murder is still unclear. We assume that Salander is a psychopath. But even psychopaths need motives.
What do you suggest?
I don't know. Someone searched Bjurman's apartment. First question, who? Second question, why? What was it we missed?
Yevka?
Holmberg gave a resigned sigh.
Okay, I'll go through the apartment, this time with tweezers.
Salander woke up at 11 on Monday morning. She lay dozing for about half an hour before she got up, put on coffee and took a shower. Then she made herself some breakfast and sat down at her power book for an update on what was happening in Prosecutor Ekstrom's computer and to read the online editions of the papers. Interest in the Enschede murders had evidently declined. Then she opened Svensson's research folder and read through his notes from his meeting with the journalist Per-Åke Sandström, the John who ran errands for the sex mafia and who knew something about Zala. When she was finished, she poured herself more coffee and sat in her window seat to think. By 4, she had thought enough. She needed cash. She had 3 credit cards. One of them was in her own name, and so for all practical purposes, useless. One was issued to Irene Nesser, but she wanted to avoid using it, since identifying herself with Irene Nesser's passport would be risky. One was issued to Wasp Enterprises, and was linked to an account that held about 3 million kroner and could be replenished with transfers via the internet. Anyone could use the card, but they would have to identify themselves. She went into the kitchen, opened a biscuit tin, and took out a wad of banknotes. She had 950 kroner in cash. Not a whole lot. Fortunately, she also had 1,800 American dollars that had been lying around since she returned from her travels. She could exchange them without ID at a forex currency window. That improved the situation. She put on Irene Nesser's wig, dressed up, and put a change of clothes and a box of theatre makeup in a backpack. Then she set off on her second expedition from Mörsebacke. She walked to Folkungagaten, and then down to Estergaten, and got to the Watzke shop just before closing time. She bought electrical tape and a block and tackle with 8 yards of cotton rope. She took the number 66 bus back. At Medburger Platzen, she saw a woman waiting for the bus. She did not recognize her at first, but an alarm went off in the back of her mind, and when she looked again she realized that the woman was Irene Flemström, the salaries clerk at Milton Security. She had a new, trendier hairdo. Salander slipped off the bus as Flemström got on. She looked around carefully, searching, as always, for faces that might be familiar. She walked past the semicircular Bofilsburger apartment building to Södra Station, and took the local train north. Inspector Murdoch shook hands with Berger, who immediately offered her some coffee. She noticed that all the mugs in the kitchenette had logos and ads for political parties and professional organizations.
"They're mostly from election night parties and interviews," Berger explained, handing her a Liberal Youth Party mug.
Murdoch worked at Svensson's old desk. Eriksson offered to help, both in explaining what Svensson's book and article were about, and in navigating the research material. Murdoch was impressed by the scope of it. It had been an irritation for the investigative team that Svensson's computer was missing and that his work seemed inaccessible. But in fact, backups had been made of most of it, and had been available all along at the Millennium offices.
Blomqvist was not in the office, but Berger gave Mördig a list of the material he had taken from Svensson's desk, which dealt exclusively with the identity of sources. Mördig called Bublansky and explained the situation. They decided that all of the material on Svensson's desk, including Millennium's computer, would have to be confiscated, and that Bublansky would return with a warrant if necessary to requisition the material that Blomqvist had already removed. Mördig then drew up a confiscation inventory, and Cortez helped her carry the cardboard boxes down to her car. On Monday evening, Blomqvist was feeling deeply frustrated. He had now checked off 10 of the names Svensson had intended to expose. In each instance he had encountered worried, excitable, and shocked men. He estimated their average income at around 400,000 kroner a year. They were a group of pathetic, frightened individuals. He had not felt, however, that any of them had anything to hide with respect to the murders. Blomqvist opened his iBook to check whether he had a new message from Salander. He did not. In her previous note she had said that the Johns were of no interest and that he was wasting his time with them. He cursed her with a string of expletives. He was hungry, but he did not feel like making himself supper. Besides, he hadn't been shopping for 2 weeks, except to buy milk from the corner store. He put on his jacket and went down to the Greek Taverna on Hornsgarten and ordered the grilled lamb. Salander first took a look at the stairwell, and at dusk made two cautious circuits of the adjacent buildings. They were low-frame buildings that she suspected were not soundproof and hardly ideal for her purposes. The journalist Sandström lived in a corner apartment on the fourth floor, the highest. Then the stairwell continued up to an attic door. It would have to do. The problem was that there was no light in any of the apartment's windows. She walked to a pizzeria a few streets away, where she ordered a Hawaiian and sat in a corner to read the evening papers. Just before 9 she bought a café latte at a press bureau kiosk and returned to the building. The apartment was still in darkness. She entered the stairwell and sat on the steps to the attic. From there she had a view of Sandström's door half a flight down. She drank her latte while she waited. Inspector Faste finally tracked down Cilla Noren, lead singer of the Satanist group Evil Fingers, at the studio of Recent Trash Records in an industrial building in Alsur. It was a cultural collision of about the same magnitude as the Spanish first encountering the Carib Indians. After several futile attempts at Noren's parents' house, Faster had succeeded at the studio, where, according to her sister, she was helping out with the production of a CD by the band Cold Wax from Borlänge. Faster had never heard of the band, which seemed to consist of guys in their 20s. As soon as he entered the corridor outside the studio, he was met by a wall of sound that took his breath away. He watched Cold Wax through a window and waited until there was a pause in the cacophony. Noren had raven black hair with red and green braids and black eye makeup. She was on the chubby side and wore a short skirt and top which revealed a pierced belly button. She had a belt full of rivets around her hips and looked like something out of a French horror movie. Faster held up his police ID and said he needed to talk to her. She went on chewing gum and gave him a skeptical look. She pointed to a door and led him into a sort of canteen, where he tripped and almost fell over a bag of trash that had been dumped right by the door. Noren ran water into an empty plastic bottle, drank about half of it, and then sat down at a table and lit a cigarette. She fixed Faster with her clear blue eyes.
"What is Recent Trash Records?"
She seemed bored out of her skull.
"It's a record company that produces new bands."
"What's your role here?"
"I'm the sound engineer."
Faster gave her a hard look.
"Are you trained to do that?"
"Nope, I taught myself."
"Can you make a living from it?"
"Why do you ask?"
"I'm just curious. I assume you've read about Lisbeth Salander in the papers lately."
She nodded.
"We believe that you know her, is that correct?"
"Could be."
"Is it correct or not correct?"
"It depends what you're looking for."
"I'm looking for an insane woman who committed a triple murder. I want information about Lisbeth Salander."
"I haven't heard from Lisbeth since last year."
"When was the last time you saw her?"
"Sometime in the fall 2 years ago, at Kvarnen. She used to hang out there, but then she stopped coming."
"Have you tried to get in touch with her?"
"I've called her mobile a few times." The number's been disconnected.
And you don't know how to get hold of her otherwise?
No.
What is Evil Fingers?
Noren looked amused.
Don't you read the papers?
What does that mean?
They say we're a Satanist band.
Are you?
Do I look like a Satanist?
What does a Satanist look like?
Well, I don't know who's dumber, the police or the newspapers.
Listen here, young lady, this is a very serious matter.
Whether we're Satanists or not?
Stop screwing around and answer the question.
And what was the question?
Faster closed his eyes for a second and thought about a visit he had paid to the police in Greece when he was on vacation some years earlier. The Greek police, despite all their problems, had one big advantage compared to the Swedish police. If this young woman had taken the same attitude over there, he would have been able to bend her over and give her three whacks with a baton. He looked at her.
Was Lisbeth Salander a member of Evil Fingers?
I wouldn't think so.
What is that supposed to mean?
Lisbeth is probably the most tone-deaf person I've ever met.
Tone-deaf?
She can tell the difference between trumpet and drums, but that's about as far as her musical talent stretches.
I mean, was she in the group Evil Fingers?
And I just answered your question. What the hell do you think Evil Fingers is?
You tell me.
You're running a police investigation by reading idiotic newspaper articles.
Answer the question.
Evil Fingers was a rock band. We were a bunch of girls in the mid-90s who liked hard rock and played for fun. We promoted ourselves with a pentagram and a little sympathy for the devil. Then the band broke up, and I'm the only one who's still working in music.
And Elizabeth Salander was not, you say, a member of the band?
Like I said.
So why do our sources claim that Salander was in the band?
Because your sources are about as stupid as the newspapers.
Explain.
There were five of us girls in the band, and we still get together now and then. In the old days we used to meet once a week at Kvarnen. Now it's about once a month. But we stay in touch.
And what do you do when you get together?
What do you think people do at Kvarnen?
Faster sighed.
So you get together to drink?
We usually drink beer. And we gossip. What do you do when you get together with your friends?
And how does Salander come into the picture?
I met her at Convux several years ago. She used to show up from time to time at Kvarnen and have a beer with us.
So Evil Fingers can't be regarded as an organization.
Noren looked at him as if he were from another planet.
Are you Dykes?
Would you like a punch in the mouth?
Answer the question.
It's none of your business what we are.
Take it easy. You can't provoke me.
Hello? The police are claiming that Lisbeth murdered three people, and you come here to ask me about my sexual preferences. You can go to hell.
You know, I could take you in.
For what? By the way, I forgot to tell you that I've been studying law for 3 years, and my father is Ulf Noren of Noren & Naip, a law firm. See you in court.
I thought you worked in the music business.
I do this because it's fun. You think I make a living doing this?
I have no idea how you make a living.
I don't make a living as a lesbian Satanist, if that's what you think. And if that's the basis of the police search for Lisbeth, then I can see why you haven't found her.
Do you know where she is?
Noren began rocking her upper body back and forth and let her hands glide up in front of her.
I can feel that she's close. Wait a minute, I'll check my telepathic powers.
Cut it out.
I've already told you I haven't heard from her for almost 2 years. I have no idea where she is. So now, if there isn't anything else...
Murdig hooked up Svensson's computer and spent the evening cataloguing the contents of his hard drive and the discs. She sat there until 11, reading his book. She came to two realizations. First, that Svensson was a brilliant writer who described the business of the sex trade with compelling objectivity. She wished he could have lectured at the police academy. His knowledge would have been a valuable addition to the curriculum. Faster, for example, could have benefited from Svensson's insights. The second realization was that Blomqvist's theory about Svensson's research, providing a motive for murder, was completely valid. Svensson's planned exposure of prostitutes' clients would have done more than merely hurt a number of men. It was a brutal revelation. Some of the prominent players, several of whom had handed down verdicts in sex crime trials or participated in the public debate, would be annihilated. The problem was that even if a John who risked being exposed had decided to murder Svensson, there was as yet no prospect of such a link to Niels Bjurman. He did not feature in Svensson's material, and that fact not only diminished the strength of Blomqvist's argument, but also reinforced the likelihood of Salander's being the only possible suspect. Even if a motive for the murders of Svensson and Johansson were still unclear, Salander had been at the crime scene, and her fingerprints were on the murder weapon. The weapon was also directly linked to the murder of Bjurman. There was a personal connection and a possible motive. The decoration on Bjurman's abdomen raised the possibility of some form of sexual assault or a sadomasochistic relationship between the two. It was impossible to imagine Bjurman having voluntarily submitted to such a bizarre and painful tattoo. Either he had found pleasure in the humiliation, or Salander, if she was the one who had done the tattooing, at first made him powerless. How it had actually happened was not something Murdig wanted to speculate about. On the other hand, Teleborian had confirmed that Salander's violence was directed at people whom she regarded as a threat, or who had offended her. He had seemed genuinely protective, as if he did not want his former patient to come to any harm. All the same, the investigation had been based largely on his analysis of her, as a sociopath on the border of psychosis. But Blomqvist's theory was attractive. She chewed her lower lip as she tried to visualize some alternative scenario to Salander the killer working alone. Finally, she wrote a line in her notebook. Two completely separate motives? Two murderers? One murder weapon? She had a fleeting thought that she could not quite pin down, but it was something she intended to ask Boblansky at the morning meeting. She could not explain why she suddenly felt so uncomfortable with the theory of Salander as a killer working alone. Then she called it a night, resolutely shut down her computer and locked the disks in her desk drawer. She put on her jacket, turned off the desk lamp, and was just about to lock the door to her office when she heard a sound further down the corridor. She frowned. She had thought she was alone in the department. She walked down the corridor to Faster's office. His door was ajar, and she heard him talking on the phone.
"It undeniably links things together," she heard him say.
She stood undecided for a moment before she took a deep breath and knocked on the door jamb. Faster looked up in surprise. She waved.
"Murdig is still in the building,"
Faster said into the phone. He listened and nodded without releasing her from his gaze.
"Okay, I'll tell her."
He hung up.
"Babble," he said in explanation. "What do you want?"
"What is it that links things together?" she asked.
He gave her a searching look.
"Were you eavesdropping?"
"No, but your door was open, and I heard you say that just as I knocked."
Faster shrugged.
"I called Bubble to tell him that the NFL have finally come up with something useful."
"What's that?"
"Svensson had a mobile with a Comviq cash card. They produced a list of calls which confirms the conversation with Mikael Blomqvist at 7:30 p.m. That's when Blomqvist was at dinner at his sister's house."
"Good. But I don't think Blomqvist has anything to do with the murders."
"Me neither. But Svensson made another call that night, at 9:34. The call lasted 3 minutes.
"And?"
"He called Niels Bjurman's home phone. In other words, there's a link between the two murders."
Murdig sank down into Faster's visitor's chair.
"Sure, have a seat, be my guest."
She ignored him.
"Okay. What does the time frame look like?"
"At 7:30, Svensson calls Blomqvist and sets up a meeting for later that evening. At 9:30, Svensson calls Bjurman. Just before closing time at 10, Salander buys cigarettes at the corner shop in Enschede. Soon after 11, Blomqvist and his sister arrive in Enschede, and at 11:11 he calls the police."
"That seems to be correct, Miss Marple."
"But it isn't correct at all. According to the pathologist, Bjurman was shot between 10 and 11 that night, by which time Salander was in Enschede.
We've been working on the assumption that Salander shot Bjurman first, and then the couple in Enschede.
That doesn't mean a thing. I talked with the pathologist again. We didn't find Bjurman until the night after, almost 24 hours later. The pathologist says that the time of death could be plus or minus an hour.
But Bjurman must have been the first victim, since we found the murder weapon in Enschede. That would mean that she shot Bjurman sometime after 9:34, and then drove to Enschede, where she bought her cigarettes. Was there enough time to get from Odenplan to Enschede?
Yes, there was. She didn't take public transportation as we assumed earlier. She had a car. Sonny Bowman and I test drove the route, and we had plenty of time.
But then she waits for an hour before she shoots Svensson and Johansson. What was she doing all that time?
She had coffee with them. We have her prints on the cup.
He gave her a triumphant look. Murdig sighed and sat silently for a minute.
Hans, you're looking at this like it's some sort of prestige thing. You can be a fucking shithead and you drive people crazy sometimes, but I actually knocked on your door to ask you to forgive me for slapping you. I was out of line.
He looked at her for a long moment.
Murdig, you might think I'm a shithead, but I think you're unprofessional and don't have any business being a police officer. At least not at this level.
Murdig weighed various replies, but in the end she just shrugged and stood up.
Well, now we know where we stand.
We know where we stand. And believe me, you're not going to last long here.
Murdig closed the door behind her harder than she meant to.
Don't let that fucking asshole get to you.
She went down to the garage. Faster smiled contentedly at the closed door. Blomqvist had just gotten home when his mobile rang.
Hi, it's Malin. Can you talk?
Sure.
Something struck me yesterday.
Tell me.
I was going through all the clippings we have here on the hunt for Salander, and I found that spread on her time at the psychiatric clinic. What I'm wondering is why there's such a big gap in her biography.
What gap?
There's plenty of stuff about the trouble she was mixed up in at school. Trouble with teachers and classmates and so on.
I remember that. There was even a teacher who said she was afraid of Lisbeth when she was 11.
Birgitta Mjort.
That's the one.
And there are details about Lisbeth at the psychiatric clinic, plus a lot of stuff about her with foster families during her teens and about the assault in Gamla Stan.
So what are you thinking?
She was taken into the clinic just before her 13th birthday.
Yes?
And there isn't a word about why she was committed. Obviously, if a 12-year-old is committed, something has to have happened. And in Lisbeth's case, it was most likely some huge outburst that should have shown up in her biography. But there's nothing there.
Blomqvist frowned. Malin, I have it from a source I trust that there's a police report on Lisbeth dated March 1991 when she was 12. It's not in the file. I was at the point of asking you to dig around for it.
If there's a report, then it would have to be a part of her file.
It would be breaking the law not to have it there.
Have you really checked?
No, but my source says that it's not in the file. Erickson paused for a second.
And how reliable is your source?
Very. Erickson and Blomqvist had arrived at the same conclusion simultaneously.
Seppo,
Erickson said.
Björk,
Blomqvist said. Chapter 24. Monday, April 4th to Tuesday, April 5th. Per-Åke Sandström, a freelance journalist in his late 40s, came home just after midnight. He was a little drunk and felt a lump of panic lurking in his stomach. He had spent the day doing nothing. He was, quite simply, terrified. It was almost 2 weeks since Svensson had been killed. Sandström had watched the TV news that night in shock. He had felt a wave of relief and hope. Svensson was dead. So maybe the book about trafficking, in which Sandström would be exposed, was history. He hated Svensson. He had begged and pleaded. He had crawled for that fucking pig. It was not until the day after that that he began to consider his situation. The police would find Svensson's text and start digging into his little escapade. Jesus. He could even be a murder suspect. His panic had subsided when Salander's face was slapped on every front page in the country. Who the hell was this Salander? He had never heard her name before. but the police clearly considered her a serious suspect, and according to the prosecutor's statement, the murders might soon be solved. It was possible that no one would show any interest in him at all, but from his own experience he knew that journalists always saved documentation and notes.
Millennium. A piece of shit magazine with an undeserved reputation. They were like all the rest, poking around and whining and damaging people.
He had no way of knowing how long the research had been going on. There was nobody he could ask. He felt as if he was in a vacuum. He vacillated between panic and intoxication. Apparently the police were not looking for him. Maybe, if he was lucky, he would get away scot-free. But if he was not lucky, his working life would be over. He stuck the key in his front door and turned the lock. When he opened the door, he suddenly heard a rustling sound behind him, and before he could turn, he felt a paralyzing pain in the small of his back. Björk had not yet gone to bed when the telephone rang. He was in his pajamas and dressing gown, but he was still sitting in the kitchen in the dark, gnawing on his dilemma. In his whole long career, he had never found himself even close to being in such a fix. He had not intended to pick up the phone. It was after midnight, but it kept ringing. After the 10th ring, he could resist no longer.
"It's Mikael Blomqvist," said a voice on the other end.
"Shit. I was in bed.
I thought you might be interested in hearing what I have to say."
"What do you want?"
"Tomorrow at 10 a.m., I'm giving a press conference on the murder of Dag Svensson and Mia Johansson."
Björk swallowed hard.
"I'm going to give an account of the details in the book about the sex trade that Svensson had all but finished. The only John I'll be naming is you."
"You promised to give me some time."
He heard the fear in his voice and stopped.
"It's been several days. You said you'd call me after the weekend. Tomorrow is Tuesday. Either you tell me now, or I'm holding that press conference in the morning."
"If you hold that press conference, you'll never find out a damn thing about Zala."
"That's possible. But then it won't be my problem any more, either. You'll have to do your talking to the police investigation instead. And to the rest of the media, of course."
There was no room for negotiation. Björk agreed to meet Blomqvist, but he succeeded in putting the meeting off until Wednesday. A short reprieve. But he was ready. It was sink or swim. He woke up on the floor of his living room. He did not know how long he had been unconscious. His body hurt all over and he couldn't move. It took him a while to realize that his hands were tied behind his back with electrical tape and his feet were bound. He had a piece of tape over his mouth. The lamps in the room were lit and the blinds were closed. He couldn't understand what had happened. He was aware of sounds that seemed to be coming from his office. He lay still and listened and heard a drawer being opened and closed.
A robbery?
He heard the sound of paper and someone rummaging through the drawers. It seemed like an eternity before he heard footsteps behind him. He tried turning his head, but he couldn't see anyone. He told himself to stay calm. Suddenly a loop of thick cotton rope was slipped over his head. A noose was tightened around his neck. The panic almost made him shit himself. He looked up and saw the rope run up to a block that was fastened to a hook where the ceiling lamp usually hung. Then the person who had assaulted him came into view. The first thing he saw was a pair of black boots. The shock could not have been greater when he raised his eyes. He did not at first recognize the psychopath whose passport photograph had been plastered outside every press bureau kiosk since Easter. She had short, black hair, and did not look that much like the picture in the papers. She was dressed all in black, jeans, mid-length cotton jacket, T-shirt, gloves. But what terrified him the most was her face. It was painted. She wore black lipstick, eyeliner, and dramatically prominent greenish-black eyeshadow. The rest of her face was covered in white makeup. She had painted a red stripe from the left side of her forehead across her nose and down to the right side of her chin. It was a grotesque mask. She looked out of her fucking mind. His brain resisted. It seemed unreal. Salander grasped the end of the rope and pulled. He felt the rope cut into his neck, and for a few seconds he couldn't breathe. Then he fought to get his feet under himself. With a block and tackle she hardly had to exert herself to pull him to his feet. When he was upright she stopped.